From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, and we're broadcasting this week from New York City, where the Alliance's 13th annual Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards are honoring television host Rachel Maddow and the Reverend Dr. Joan Brown Campbell. We'll be bringing you highlights from the ceremony on a future show.
Call the Holy Bible a hoax that was banned for mocking Christianity and Christ. Why did Rand Paul once tie a woman up, tell her to bow down before a false idol, and say his God was awkward?
Rand Paul keeps Christ in his heart and in the life he shares with his wife and three boys. What kind of shameful politician would sink this low to bear false witness against another man just to win an election?
It's not the first time such explicitly religious language has found its way into political advertising. But this election season may suffer from the most extreme and widespread use of this tactic. I'm not encouraged by the fact that it's more bipartisan than ever. And we'll take a closer look at recent campaign ads in Kentucky to explore the reason.
Democrats and Republicans live there. We pay rent to subsidize the house itself so that they can use it for people who are coming from other countries that they're trying to encourage to come to that prayer breakfast. No, it's hardly religious at all.
Hardly religious at all? That's South Carolina Senator Jim DeMint in 2004 talking about his association with the C Street House in Washington, D.C., run by the organization known as The Family. You heard what he said. Well, author Jeff Charlotte would disagree with that, and he will, when we bring you part two of our interview with this best-selling author of C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy, later in the show.
I never told my parents about the bullying because I didn't want to admit to them that I wasn't cool. Plus, I was afraid of my father. He was a bully. He yelled a lot, and he was explosive. He hit my older brothers, and I didn't want him to tell me that I should toughen up.
Bullying has received a lot of attention lately, and writer Weezy Shapiro contributes a perspective that I think we are wise to explore. She spoke to a number of kids who were subject to bullying, and she's written Bullying and Me, Schoolyard Stories. The author is with us in the studio. But first, to help us get a handle on the latest developments in this most unusual election season, I mean, it's plain crazy, isn't it? Some of the candidates are called crazy, some of them less crazy, some of them almost sane. I don't know that whether anybody's getting called sane or not, but it's a crazy season. Well, I'm very happy to welcome back a very sane person to State of Belief Radio, Sarah Posner, a friend of the show, a friend of mine, associate editor at Religion Dispatches, where she covers politics for the site. Now, she can help us. Sarah is the author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Welton. How are you?
I'm fine. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Sarah, your latest piece on religiondispatches.org addresses the influence of conservative American Christians on what you call attempts to exterminate LGBT people in Uganda. Is that an overstatement, or what are you talking about?
Well, this week I had the opportunity to speak with Julius Kagwa, who is a human rights activist in Uganda and has been active in a coalition of groups that were instrumental in raising awareness of and stopping passage, for the time being, of the anti-homosexuality bill in Uganda. Now, that bill, which would call for the death penalty for certain activities that it envisions as being homosexual activity and deviance, is probably one of the most draconian anti-gay measures in the world, and parts of it could still be passed in other pieces of legislation in Uganda. So what Kagwa and other activists there are doing is very important. Now, this week, or last week rather, a newspaper in Uganda published the identities and addresses of 100 people the newspaper claimed were gay, and under the headline, Hang Them. Mm. And there has been a great deal of, even though this anti-homosexuality bill has not been passed, which if it did pass would authorize the state to execute people for homosexuality, even though that hasn't passed, CAGWA tells me that a great deal of non-state violence perpetrated against people who are gay or perceived to be gay continues in Uganda with the complicity of the Ugandan government. And so given that, and you know, the word exterminate was a word that CAGWA used with me in the interview, because given that the state is looking the other way when people are harassing, torturing, and even killing gay people or people they perceive to be gay, and they are given this sanction by the state and also by religious figures.
How scary. And so it really is the word to use, and people need to go to religiondispatches.org and read your piece on this. And unfortunately, there are American sources influencing that terrible situation there, and some of them will be surprising to you because of their religious credentials. Sarah, I've got to talk about this year's political campaigns. I think maybe the best way to do it, I want to throw out three or four statements about this last week, and you just react to them.
Okay.
Minnesota pastors endorsing from the pulpit.
Well, you know, that is not new. We've been having that in elections at least since 2004. And because the IRS rules are so particular, and the IRS rarely enforces the rule against endorsing candidates from the pulpit, you very rarely see someone have their tax-exempt status taken away for that. But there are a group of pastors led by the Alliance Defense Fund, and they started this a couple of years ago, who really want to have a test case so they can take the issue of whether pastors can endorse from the pulpit all the way up to the Supreme Court. They charge that it violates the First Amendment.
One church has posted its political endorsements online. Is that a part of a new creed?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think that this is part of a pattern or a continuation of a trend that we've seen over the last few election cycles. Now, it's based on my knowledge of the IRS rules, they cannot use church resources to issue an endorsement. So the pastor can walk across the street and in the Pancake House parking lot talk about who people should vote for, who he thinks people should vote for, but he can't use church letterhead, he can't do it from the pulpit during church service, and so on. Is putting it on the website using church resources? It would appear so, but I don't know where the IRS is going to come down on that.
Yeah, especially if God hasn't told the IRS the same thing that has been told to the one doing the endorsing. Listen, a Tennessee court ruled this week that Islam is a religion. Now, isn't that a revelation? Did you ever think we'd be questioning that in a court of law?
I did not. But that, I think, is indicative of the level of hysteria, of the Islamophobic hysteria that the conservative movement has whipped up and has been whipping up since 9/11, but is really bringing it to a head since the proposed Park 51 project in New York, and I think also in the context of the election of Barack Obama. All the smears about him being a Muslim and the increasing numbers of Americans who believe he's a Muslim, or at least say that they don't know that he's a Christian. And I think that this is very much a product of the conservative noise machine of Fox News just whipping up this frenzy of, you know, Islam is about to cause the downfall of Western civilization. I mean, this comes out of many conservative evangelical churches as well, but I think that the conservative media has given it a bigger, wider platform.
My guest has been Sarah Posner, Associate Editor at Religion Dispatches, which you can read at religiondispatches.org. She's the author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Folks, if you think this is a crazy election, you're right. Stay tuned. It isn't ending yet. And Sarah will be with us again to talk about that. We always count on her for such good analysis like we got today. Sarah, great thanks for taking the time to be with us again on State of Belief.
Thank you, Welton.
I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. Still ahead on this week's show, part two of my interview with best-selling author Jeff Charlotte. He's been investigating the widespread influence of the organization known as The Family on American politics and around the world, and you'll hear more about this new book, C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy. But up next, author Wheezy Shapiro, whose book Bullying in Me, Schoolyard Stories, explores the topic from the viewpoint of kids who have been bullied. The author is with us in the studio. Stay tuned to State of Belief Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. There's a lot of attention being paid recently to bullying, and rightly so. This past week, Interfaith Alliance signed on to a letter expressing the concern of many faith leaders on this subject. The document, called Clergy Against Bullying, is available at our website, stateofbelief.com. Many of us firmly believe that bullying for any reason is contradictory to authentic religion. My next guest has written a book on the subject of bullying. It's called Bullying and Me, Schoolyard Stories. I'm very pleased to have Wheezy Shapiro join us in the studio. Wheezy, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you for having me.
What moved you to write this book?
Well, I had written a book about autism, and it was a book about looking at typical siblings of kids with autism and how the typical siblings deal with it. And I was looking for another subject that was a social issue that was affecting kids. And everywhere I looked, I was seeing incidences of bullying, and it was just so disturbing to me that I thought this is a really important topic that needs to be addressed, and specifically to younger kids, because the bullying starts so young now.
Where did you look? Where did you get the stories?
I started contacting schools. I live in New York City, so I started contacting public schools and principals, and word of mouth just got around, and everybody I knew had a story. And the next thing I knew, people were calling me and asking me if their kids could be interviewed. But I will tell you that a lot of the kids who are victims of bullying are very reluctant to talk about their stories. There's almost like a stigma attached to being a victim of bullying, which is so unfortunate.
And this is unfair probably, but can you tell me a story that you found particularly affecting?
I think a lot of the stories in the book are particularly affecting. One boy suffered terrible burns on his face when he was a toddler, and he's been bullied because of his physical scarring ever since. And it's just so upsetting. And I think that actually the response on the part of his principal, he's an elementary school student, and his principal could see that other kids were making fun of him. And so what he did was he made him his special, he gave him a job, and he was the principal's assistant. He gave him keys to the principal's office, and he told him that he was going to be his helper all year. And so he felt very special. And I think that it really made a difference in his life. And even kids were starting to feel jealous of him because he was being treated like a special kid.
Huh. I see you have the very attractive book with you. Would you read us just a bit of the book, Bullying and Me, Schoolyard Stories?
Sure. And before I do, I'll just say that this issue is so complex because it's sometimes the way a kid handles it, which makes perfect sense, doesn't work. Sometimes going to the school helps, and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes going to parents helps, and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes talking to a friend helps, and sometimes it doesn't. So you often just don't know what to do. And a lot of times parents just throw up their hands. They just are so confused. Mm-hmm. This is a case of a boy named Rich who was bullied when he was in elementary school. And he says, I never told my parents about the bullying because I didn't want to admit to them that I wasn't cool. Plus, I was afraid of my father. He was a bully. He yelled a lot, and he was explosive. he hit my older brothers, and I didn't want him to tell me that I should toughen up. I also didn't know what Peter and his friends would do if they knew I had told on them.
Weezy, can a book like yours make a difference to young readers?
I hope that it can. I think there's a lot of advice in the book by a school psychologist about what to do. She looks at each incident in the book, and she gives her opinion about how kids might, what the victims might have done differently, or appraises them for how they handled the situation. And there's also tips at the back of the book that explains what to do if you witness bullying, if you're a victim of bullying.
I know that you want other people to read the book and become active in the cause of opposing this. Got to have a short answer, but what did your discovery of bullying and its impact do to you personally?
It made me see that the world is a very complicated place, and that bullying can be, bullying can be anything. It can be cyberbullying, it can be physical bullying, it can be emotional bullying. And it just affected me in a way that made me feel very sensitive to what kids are going through as they grow up. And to parents, I think, and to schools. I mean, I think that the school administrators are also wringing their hands, not knowing exactly how to handle situations.
Weezy Shapiro is the author of Bullying and Me, Schoolyard Stories. It's out now from Albert Whitman and Company. Weezy, I really appreciate you joining us today on State of Belief, informing us and letting us in turn inform others.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. There's a lot more still to come on this week's show, so don't go away. Does keeping Christ in your heart qualify you for a congressional seat? Does harsh political rhetoric disqualify you? We'll take a closer look at the dueling campaign ads in the Kentucky senatorial race. And up next, part two of my interview with best-selling author Jeff Charlotte. I know you want to hear it. He's out with a new book, C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy. We're going to talk about some of the chilling connections between religion and power that Jeff has uncovered. This is State of Belief Radio. We'll be right back. We're brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, and we'll see you in a moment. Welcome back, everybody. This is State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. We have the privilege of talking to many respected authors on this show, and I've recommended many of their books. But for in-depth reporting on a subject that I sincerely believe poses a threat to our very democracy, I'll go beyond recommending and urge you to read the work of our next guest, Jeff Charlotte. Without ever resorting to hyperbole or sensationalism, Jeff lays out a compelling case of concern about a well-organized fundamentalist quest for influence and power that permeate Washington and radiate to other parts of our nation and the world. Here's part two of my interview with Jeff Charlotte. Jeff, you tell a very compelling story about the way King David is used as a model within the rhetoric of the family. I mean, is that because King David had trouble with his wife and was also a great religious leader? Talk about that for a minute.
That's exactly it. That's what drew me back to the story. You know, when Governor Sanford, justifying his decision to stay in office after he had called on President Clinton to step down in similar circumstances, brings up King David. He's meeting with his staff, and he says, I guess Clinton's just a president. Mark Sanford's more like a king. The Bathsheba story. King David, remember, sees this beautiful woman, Bathsheba, says to his guards, bring her to me, seduces her, and she's married, and he wants to get her husband out of the picture, so he arranges to have him killed, and yet he's still king. And so now the meaning of that story, the role of the prophet Nathan, the role of those who came and counseled King David, all that gets lost in their telling. They see this as if you're chosen for power, it doesn't really matter what you do. And the reason that drew me back into it is because that was one of my introductions to the organization when I lived with them for a month and then discovered as a boilerplate in their thousands of documents. This was one idea that they had first expressed to me with the illustration of chosenness David Coe, son of Doug Coe, leader in the group, trying to explain what chosen means, that King David story. He turns to a young man and says, suppose I hear you rape three little girls, what would I think of you? And the young man, of course, says, you think I'm terrible? And he says, no, I wouldn't, because you're chosen. Interesting set of rules, isn't it?
Mm.
He goes on to say that when you're chosen, you're sort of, it's not that you should do these terrible things, but your position of power isn't affected by that. It's morality, he says. Morality is kid stuff. That was the quote. Morality is for you and me, Wilton. It's not for these guys they see as chosen by God.
So, Jeff, what are the criteria by which you decide who's chosen?
One of the things that makes the family different from, Pat Robertson or James Dobson or these guys is that in a lot of ways they're much more ideologically malleable. They're bipartisan, mostly Republican, mostly conservative, but there's always a few Democrats and even a few liberals who are sort of seduced by this wonderful rhetoric of Jesus plus nothing. They think this is lovely. Senator Mark Pryor, Democrat from Arkansas, told me that he'd learned all about bipartisanship in the family. He said that Jesus didn't come to take sides, he came to take over. Well, if that's your idea of bipartisanship, this is the group for you. That's what allows them to endure, is because they're not speaking the kind of the angry language out there. It's a very soft sell kind of fundamentalism. It's appealing. They'll even get some liberal Democrats to come out and say, hey, I know Doug Coe. He's a nice guy. And it all is revolving around this idea expressed by Doug Coe. We work with power where we can, build new power where we can't.
You know, Jeff, the subtitle of your book is The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy. And if I understand correctly, you're not talking about them because you're afraid of biblical fundamentalism or even because you're prejudiced against political conservatism. You see that this group is up to something that is detrimental to democracy itself. Is that right?
I have no problem with fundamentalism. In fact, I've been very encouraged by the investigative reporting on C Street being conducted by World Magazine, which is probably the leading fundamentalist magazine out there. You know, remember, mm-hmm. fundamentalism, I mean, you know this well.
Sure.
A lot of listeners know fundamentalism is at its roots, a small D democratic tradition, as is American evangelicalism. You know, I look at the family, and I see it in some ways as a tragic group, a tragic kind of wrong turn in the idea of seeking power. You know, this idea that we help the weak. They do want to help the weak. We help the weak best by helping the strong.
Mm-hmm.
That's a tragic mistake. Mm-hmm. I'm not opposed to fundamentalism. I'm not opposed to political conservatism. In fact, I've just been just thrilled to work with political conservatives, mm-hmm. and trying to bring this to light. What I'm concerned with is the folks who are trying to do their religion and their politics. They're trying to shape government, but they don't want to do it with transparency. This isn't a left-right issue. This is a transparency issue. Mm-hmm. You go out there in the public square, like Pat Robertson. We may not disagree with Pat Robertson, but we know what he believes.
Mm-hmm.
He's out there in the public square. We can have that debate. You know, I end the book with a quote from maybe America's worst president, James Buchanan, who had this one good insight at a time when a lot of people out there were saying, oh, let's have, you know, bipartisanship, harmony, unity. We should all be on the same page. James Buchanan said, I like the noise of democracy, the noise of democracy. Democracy is about debate. Democracy is not about erasing differences, but about arguing over them. The evangelical tradition, especially the fundamentalist tradition, where my family is from in Tennessee, you get one church, and then you go to half a mile down the road, and you got a breakaway church from that church because they couldn't stand them, and then half a mile down the road, you got another church, and they're all arguing. That's the noise of democracy.
Yeah, well, our religious tradition is very much the same.
Senator Jim DeMint, longtime resident of the C Street House, tried to defend what they're doing there. He says, this is all about accountability. That's why we can't let you know what's going on. You know, accountability doesn't happen behind closed doors. Accountability happens out in the open. Senator Jim DeMint wants to make his case, and I have to give him credit. He is not shy about making his case for a leadership led by God. But we want to get that out in the open, and we want to look also, when you have that lack of transparency, suddenly you see things like influence in countries, little countries far off the radar like Uganda, where the family's had a tremendous impact on that country, and now they're you've got the situation where they're proposing the death penalty for homosexuality and so on. That goes beyond what the Americans wanted. That's not what they intended. They said, we didn't pull the trigger. We didn't kill anybody. And that's true. They built the gun and they put it on the table. And now they're not taking responsibility for that. There's no accountability. So let's bring that into the public square, that debate. Let's have the noise of democracy. And then they get their chance to say their piece and we get ours.
Jeff, you write about your concern about the Centers for Power. The family's established in Washington, but you've also mentioned cells, as they're called in other parts of the country.
Let me just explain the word cells, because, you know, that's a pretty sensationalistic term, but it is their term, and today it has a kind of terrorist connotation, but it goes back to the early 1940s. This group is old. They go back to 1935. In the early 1940s, they were really impressed by communist organizing. They were very impressed by the Bolshevik Revolution. They studied it. They said, you know, what was so great about that is you had a small group of people able to transform a whole society, you know, this avant-garde idea. So that's where they get this idea of cells from, and they talk about prayer cells and so on. Mm-hmm. In the book I talk about, for instance, fall in the real estate a little bit, one property in Denver, Colorado that a reporter out there looked at called the Downing Street House, and there was a whole foundation built up around it, and within the foundation there was a business engaged with oil and gas and so on, and the whole existence of this thing was premised, according to their tax records, kicking money up to Washington. And you get that kind of thing replicated. You get other situations like out in Kansas right now. Kansas, you got Senator Sam Brownback, former C Streeter, and he's about to become governor. He thinks he can make a better run for president if he serves as governor. So replacing him as senator is going to be Representative Jerry Moran, also lives in C Street. And he had to beat out in a primary, Republican primary, which is the only real race there, Representative Todd Tehart, who seeks a spiritual counsel at C Street. So it's Kansas. It's head C Street wins, tail C Street's wins. The spectrum has getting awfully narrow there. Whether you're conservative or liberal, you're not really having a choice. I'll just end on this note, because the good news is you see all over the country, you see local reporters, you see the local press doing what the press is supposed to do. Tennessee, and going to Representative Zach Womp, lives at C Street, and asking him tough questions. Wichita TV News asking Representative Todd Tehart tough questions. Up in Michigan, or conservative Democrat Bart Stupak, C Streeter, a lot of press asking him a lot of questions about the role C Street did or did not play in his Stupak Pitt anti-abortion amendment. Get those questions out there. You don't have to let your reporters do it. You can do it too. They are your representatives. Ask those questions and bring the noise of democracy right down to the local level.
Jeff Charlotte, congratulations on the new book. It's out now from Little Brown in hardcover, C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy. Thank you for joining us again on State of Belief. It's always great to have you on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. It's always good to be with you.
Up next, religion in politics. When this show launched 5 years ago, I don't think any of us imagined just how crowded the intersection between these two subjects would become. We'll talk about some of what is lost when the focus in electioneering becomes faith. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. You'll like this or not like it, but want to hear it. This is State of Belief Radio. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. Friends, I apologize for being a little bit preoccupied with what's going on in the political arena, but it really is disturbing. In the final weeks before the midterm elections, religious rhetoric in political campaigns has escalated to a level I don't remember from past years, and it's most notable for its pervasiveness. It's difficult to choose any one story to highlight, but we're going to take a chance on doing that and focus on the Kentucky senatorial race. Listen.
Why was Rand Paul a member of a secret society that called the Holy Bible a hoax that was banned for mocking Christianity and Christ? Why did Rand Paul once tie a woman up, tell her to bow down before a false idol, and say his God was Aqua Buddha?
Wow. Those are not pretty accusations. But the truth is that an awful lot of effective political leaders, and religious leaders for that matter,
would fail the test if we were to scrutinize their behavior, should we say our behavior, during college years. Democratic candidate Chuck Conway draws on reports in GQ magazine to imply hypocrisy on the part of his opponent. Now, frankly, there are a lot of easy and legitimate ways to rebut this kind of attack, but here's the way the Paul campaign chose to do it.
Rand Paul keeps Christ in his heart and in the life he shares with his wife and three boys.
Wait. What are you saying?
What kind of shameful politician would sink this low to bear false witness against another man?
Did you hear that? Did you catch that in the 2010 race for one of the two United States Senate seats from Kentucky? The voters are helpless without Moses. Cast your vote based on which of the Ten Commandments is your favorite, bearing false witness or worshiping false idols. Now look, there well may be legitimate differences between these two candidates in areas of politics and policy, but Kentucky voters are going to have a hard time finding what those are past this current debate. Worse, every time voters are subject to this kind of messaging, it inevitably legitimizes dragging religion into political discourse. It desensitizes people to just how inappropriate and destructive the Christ in your heart, Aqua Buddha litmus test really is. In the name of religion, these candidates are giving religion a bad name. Do they care? Well, you be the judge on that one. As Sarah Posner has repeatedly pointed out on religiondispatches.org, the focus on media response to the most extreme statements by candidates, especially on the right, drowns out thoughtful analysis of the extremist positions behind the statements that provoke that analysis. Now, this past week, many of us chuckled about Christine O'Donnell's apparent ignorance of the separation of church and state clause in the First Amendment. There's been debate about whether, in fact, she was addressing the presence of that exact phrase rather than the fundamental principle. But, you know, all of this is a diversion that the mainstream media should not be falling for. Has everybody lost sense of the issues most essential in electoral campaigns for political offices? If Christine O'Donnell or any other candidate wants to talk about religion, all that I want to know is whether they intend to use their office to advance only their religion or whether they are committed to treating every citizen of the U.S. equally, regardless of any person's religion. O'Donnell's statements are not going to significantly damage her chances in this extraordinary election year. The very real threat to the separation of church and state, in practice, if not in the Constitution, is hidden behind the charming and self-effacing personality of this and other candidates. The media will continue to laugh at her. Her base will continue to laugh with her. And if she's elected, Christine O'Donnell is likely to participate in an unprecedented assault on religious liberties in America. What will the mainstream media do then? Most likely, they'll have moved on to the next Lindsay Lohan story. Meanwhile, in Minnesota, 100 pastors joined in a candidate endorsement Sunday organized by Alliance Defense Fund, a religious right legal outfit affiliated with James Dobson's Focus on the Family. At least one pastor has blatantly posted his endorsements on his church website. Dan Severson, the Republican candidate for Minnesota Secretary of State, has declared he does not believe in the separation of church and state. Perhaps Minnesotans will express their belief in the separation of secretary and state. There was a time when the Fourth Estate was considered an essential component of our democracy. The need for a well-informed electorate, Thomas Jefferson's reasoning for public education, applies just as much to the need for continuing education via a responsible media. But we're not seeing it. And the apparent futility of making this complaint over and over does not in any way reduce the price we're all paying for the fact that it is true. In the remaining days of this electoral process, could we quit talking about Aqua Buddha or Jesus Christ and cease citing scriptures and quoting sacred sayings and talk about candidates' loyalty to the U.S. Constitution, their promise to strengthen the public's welfare, and to their commitment or lack thereof to spend their time and energy on the work of democracy and international diplomacy? Is that too much to ask? Their words about religion would not be so offensive if any of their actions bore even a hint that real religion mattered to them in this campaign. Well, goodness, that's all the time we've got for this week's edition of State of Belief Radio. But you can visit us online at stateofbelief.com anytime. Find out more about the show, listen to show archives, sign up for our podcast. That's stateofbelief.com. Please tell a friend about our show and encourage them to sign up too. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. There's not been a time in recent memory where the cause of religious liberty needed more support. Join us today, please. Become a member. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. We'll be right back here next week on State of Belief Radio. We're going to have more stories from the intersection of religion and politics. But until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.